Amen. One of the things that we think about when it comes to the secular world involves the qualifications of someone. If we're going to ask someone to work for us, if we're going to ask someone to do a job, one of the things that we might inquire about would be the qualifications. Are you qualified to help? Are you qualified to do the job? Well, this study is designed to talk about some of the ways in which God can help his people. And one of the things that needs to be studied as far as introductory material is, what are God's qualifications? What's he like? What assets does he have? What resources, what tools are at his disposal to help us? We took 20 passages in last week's study to show some of the things, some of the qualities that God has. And tonight we've got about 20 more passages to get through this introductory material. We find this statement, he says, as we learn more about God, we can see why people of all ages addressed him with great reverence and adoration. We shall learn even more about him from the scriptures which follow. And that is right. When we begin to see who God is, we begin to see why people of all ages, people throughout time, have chosen to honor him, worship him, serve him, and get help from him. Hopefully you've gone through the material already and had a chance to fill in the blanks, but we're going to look at the passages. We'll get our first two helpers lined up, an Old Testament reference and a New Testament reference. Old Testament reference, Steve will take that. That's going to be 1 Samuel 16, verse 7. 1 Samuel 16, 7, and then we'll look at our New Testament reference from Romans 14, Romans 14, verse 12. Romans 14, 12. Jeff. Okay, Steve, if you're ready, 1 Samuel 16, verse 7.
But Jehovah said unto Samuel, look not on his countenance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For Jehovah seeth not as a man seeth, for man looketh on the outward appearance, but Jehovah looketh on the heart.
Thank you. Now let's fill in a blank. God, when it comes to who he is, he sees, he does not see as man sees. God looks on the heart. He's looking on the inside. He's seeing the true character, the true nature of someone. And then that second blank, and not on the countenance or the height of one's statue. Jesus is a perfect illustration of this. When you look at the Lord's life, you find that there were times where the Lord looked at somebody. And that look, it was not just, well, okay, he's 5'8" and, you know, 145 pounds, those kinds of things, but he actually knew what was going on inside the mind, or the head of a person. He had a full, he had a good understanding. And that's one of the qualities, that's one of the traits of deities. Can you think of some ways in which we might look on someone today? We're maybe basing that evaluation more on what we see than what the circumstance really is. Our judgment is a miscalculation. Are there times that happens?
Certainly. We even go to the church, we talk about the poor man and the rich man. Mm-hmm. I take a look at one of those. We judge them by the way they dress.
Somebody walks through the door on Sunday morning. We've never seen him before. Would you say that at least 90% of the group probably makes an assumption about that person? I think so. What might some of those Sunday morning assumptions be? Somebody comes in, you know, we can't look on the heart like God does, but in this first lesson, 1 Samuel 16, what kinds of conclusions might be drawn?
The man's not dressed very well, so therefore he's after some money.
All right, that might be one. Person comes in, and maybe it looks like they haven't bathed for a little while. He's probably looking for some help. More than a few have thought that. What else? Superficial judgment. Come on. I know there's some other things that have gone through the minds of people.
Intelligence?
All right. Or the lack thereof.
Right.
We sometimes make a judgment about a person's intellectual abilities. Ray mentioned poverty and riches. We might make a judgment about how they're dressed. Clean, dirty. What else? You ever see somebody walk through a door and you wonder if he might be a preacher in another congregation? That might take another minute or two after they get through the door, but talk to them for a minute. You might wonder. Anybody ever wonder, maybe after you've spent a couple minutes with somebody, if a person might serve as an elder or as maybe an elder's wife in another congregation? I did last Sunday. Folks that came to visit Ray and Judy. I thought that fella might have served as an elder before. Now, it was just a guess on my part, but that turned out to be a pretty good guess. So we do make judgments. Sometimes they're fairly close to the truth, and other times we are just way off, as we see in 1 Samuel 16. All right, then Romans 14, verse 12. Let's take this next one.
So then, every one of us shall give account of himself to God.
Okay. When we think about that word account, and that's what we want for the blank, what's another word for that? Each one of us is going to one day give a... All right, an account, or we might also say an... Okay, there's going to be reckoning. There's going to be some reporting, if you will. Now today, if people give an account of something, again, it's kind of like 1 Samuel chapter 16. It can take a lot of different forms. What kind of account might we give? Somebody says, explain this to me. Well, what would be some of the options that might happen when they give that explanation or that account?
All right.
Right. They could be fully and completely honest. You know, we're doing the best of our ability to give you a full accounting. This is the best recollection that we have. And that is hopefully what happens. But there are going to be some other people that do some other things. What would some of the other options be? Yeah. There might be some things that are not... Let's sweep them under the rug. Some things that are not quite so favorable to this particular case. And they might not just sweep some things under the rug. What might they do? It happened this way, but they're going to say it happened the other way. It's 180 degrees difference. So when we think about people giving an accounting to God, Romans 14, what kind of account is that going to be? I mean, he's already got the information. Will there be any way to twist, to distort, to lie? Nothing's going to be omitted. Nothing is going to be overstated. There's not going to be any kind of embellishment. There's not going to be any kind of deletion. So when we think about God, he does see on the heart, 1 Samuel 16. But he also, as we now think about Romans chapter 14, he doesn't miss anything. He's completely honest, he's completely forthright, and he's going to require that of us at the proper time. All right, next two references are from the Old Testament, Psalm 139, verses 1 through 4, and then from the book of Isaiah, chapter 55, verses 8 and 9. Who wants to take care of Psalm 139, the first four verses for us? Betty? And then from the book of Isaiah, chapter 55, verses 8 and 9. We'll get somebody lined up for that. That'll be Lois, Isaiah 55, 8 and 9. Betty, when you're ready, Psalm 139, verses 1 through 4.
The Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my downstanding and my uprising. Thou understandest my thoughts afar off. Thou compassest my path and my lying down, and thou acquaintest with all my ways. For there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, thou knowest it all together.
Thank you. Let's pick up the part of the verse that we need to fill in the blank for. For he understands our thought or thoughts. How far off? Way off. And then he knows how many words? Every word in our tongue. That's a way of saying that before we even speak a word, God knows that it's there. Sometimes we'll find a person who comes along and says, you don't know what I'm thinking. I might not. 1 Samuel 16, because I'm just looking on the exterior. I might look at you and sense that you're angry. I might look at you and think that you're happy. I might look at you and think 100 different things. But it's God who knows what's on the inside of a person's heart, mind, the thought process, and he knows every single word in the tongue. So as we said from Romans 14, there's not going to be any way to fool him or deceive him. Lois, Isaiah chapter 55, verses 8 and 9. Okay, so if we were to take that verse and fill it in according to the material that we have, his what? His thoughts and his ways. Now that's interesting. Person might say, well, one of those concerning me is greater than what you have. My thoughts are greater than your thoughts, my ways are greater than your ways, but God says both things. And not only are his thoughts and ways greater than ours, how much greater are they? They're just off the chart. There's no way for us to compete with God. When you go back and you look at some of the Old Testament prophets, Habakkuk is a good example of that. God says, I'm working a work. And even if I were to try to explain it to you, would you get it? God said, it's just beyond your comprehension. The idea of sending Jesus into the world to die on a cross for the sins of mankind. As you look at what Paul said, there were people who looked at that plan and they counted that as a stumbling block. It just seemed like that doesn't make any sense. But God said, my plans, my thoughts, my ways are higher than your ways. Even though that's true, we probably recognize that on an intellectual level. Do you think there are times where we suspect that our thoughts are greater than God's thoughts, or at least equal? If we're honest, do you think so? You pray about a matter, and it doesn't go as far as the prayer exactly how you thought. You ever think that there are some Christians who think that God failed? God just didn't understand? I would say there are probably more people around that have that kind of thought than we might like to think or acknowledge. But what's Isaiah tell us? Isaiah 55 verses 8 and 9. Is he aware of those thoughts that we have when it comes to prayer? We just pick up the verse. It said he knows that, what's on our tongue, even before it gets there. And now his thoughts, his ways are higher than our ways. And that's, I think, a helpful point to remember when we think about prayer. There may be some times where it's a no answer, but it's no because God either has knowledge that we don't have, or there is a better way, or what we think is the best way, it's not going to be a good way at all. Maybe very, very dangerous.
Actually, every one of us have done that. Because when we don't turn to God for a prayer and we think we can do it ourselves, we decided that we were smarter than God.
Yeah. And it is a big problem, and it's a problem that a lot of times people are just not willing to face or admit. But if we're brutally honest, I think that you can find if people who've lived very long as a Christian, at some point in time, they're going to have gone down that path. So it's a good reminder that God says, look, I know the heart, I know what you're thinking, and my ways are far better, far more comprehensive than your ways. And that's sometimes a humbling thought, but it's an important one.
We had a lot of examples in the Old Testament of that. David, Abraham, Isaac, Moses. My ways are good or better than
your
ways.
Well, Sarah, look at her. We need a child, so, we'll go through Hagar and Ishmael and the whole bit, and we know where that led, even in today's world. The kings, the same kinds of alliances. God says, I'll protect you. Well, it's, Egypt is attractive. It's not very far down there, and let's try to go down and have a political marriage and have an alliance. So, yeah. We want an earthly king. You do see that time and time again, and it's still an age-old problem that we just can't conquer. Anybody else? Okay, next two passages are going to come from, the New Testament and the Old, splitting them. Acts 10:34 is where we'll go in just a minute. Margaret, that'll be you. And then after that, we'll take a look in the Old Testament, Psalm 55. That'll be Psalm 55:22. Who wants to take Brian? Okay, Margaret, if you're ready, Acts 10, verse 34. Okay, this is an encouraging verse. God is no respecter of persons. That's another way of communicating what point?
You're all equal.
All right, you're all equal. There is no partiality with God. There is no way to curry or buy favoritism with Him. Now, in our world, that's a difficult thing to get. If you're a politician, you're probably going to have somebody that's put some money in your pocket, and you're probably going to be expected to do some favors or maybe vote in a particular way. People sometimes will say, I've done so many good things for you, and you now need to do this for me. You are in my debt. But God's not in anybody's debt. He never is the respecter of persons. He can't be bullied. There's nothing that we can do to curry His favor. We can, however, do what? Can't bully Him, can't buy Him, but we can be obedient, be classified as a son, a daughter of God, and then we're in that relationship where He wants to help us. But aside from that, there is no favoritism with Him. All right, let's pick up then with that Old Testament reference, Psalm 55, verse 22. Brian?
Cast your burden on the Lord, and He shall sustain you. He will never permit the righteous to be moved.
Okay, what answer do we want here? God will sustain His people. Well, that again is encouraging. He knows all the stuff about us. His ways are higher than our ways. His thoughts are higher than our thoughts. And now God says, I'll sustain you. I'll uphold you. We saw this a little bit from our Revelation study. In the book of Revelation chapter 21, John talks about that wall, that great wall. If the explanation given in that class was right for the wall, it's John's way of saying God's people are behind that wall. God's going to protect you. He's going to sustain you. He's going to be able to care for you as long as you remain in the right relationship with Him. So it is a great, great promise. And it, once again, lays the foundation for some of the future lessons that we want to talk about as far as God's power, His ability, the ways that He can protect us as we go through life. Thoughts that you have before we move along with the next two verses? Okay. After Psalm 55:22, we've got some information from Nehemiah 9. Nehemiah 9:17 is a reference. I know it's long, but if somebody's willing to read down through verse 31, I think that information is helpful. So anybody want to read about 12 verses? Nehemiah 9:17-31? Jeff? And then after that, we'll take a look at another Old Testament passage, Psalm 89, verse 7. Psalm 89, verse 7. That'll be Steve. Okay, Jeff, let's go back to you. Nehemiah 9, start with verse 17 and read down through verse 31.
And if they refuse to obey, neither will my flow by wonder should thou be among them, but harden their necks, and in the rebellion appointed a captain to return to their bondage. But thou art God, ready to pardon, gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and of great kindness, and forsookest them not. Yea, when they had made them a molten calf, and said, This is thy God that brought thee up out of Egypt, and hath wrought great provocations. Yet thou in thy manifold mercies forsookest them not in the wilderness. The pillar of the cloud departed not from them by day to lead them in the way, neither the pillar of fire by night to show them light in the way wherein they should go. Thou gavest also thy good spirit to instruct them, and withheldest not thy manna from their mouth, and gavest them water for their thirst. Yea, 40 years didst thou sustain them in the wilderness, that they lacked nothing. Their clothes waxed not old, and their sweet feet swelled not. Moreover, thou gavest them kingdoms and nations, and did divide them into corners, so they possessed the land of Sihon, and the land of the king of Heshbon, and the land of Og, king of Bashan. Their children also multiplied as thou as the stars of heaven, and broughtest them into the land concerning which thou hadst promised to their fathers that they should go in to possess it. So the children went in and possessed the land, and thou subduest before them the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, and gavest them into their hands with their kings, and the people of the land, that they might do with them as they would. And they took strong cities and a fat land and possessed houses full of all goods, wells digged, vineyards and olive yards, and fruit trees in abundance, so they did eat, and were filled and became fat and blinded themselves in thy great goodness. Nevertheless, they were disobedient and rebelled against thee, and cast thy law behind their backs, and slew thy prophets, which testified against them to turn them to thee, and they wrought great provocations. Therefore thou deliverest them into the hand of their enemies, who vex them. In the time of their trouble, when they cried unto thee, thou heardest them from heaven. And according to thy manifold mercies, thou gavest them saviors, who saved them out of the land of their enemies. But after they had rest, they did evil again before thee. Therefore leftest thou them in the hand of their enemies, so that they had dominion over them. Yet when they returned and cried unto thee, thou heardest them from heaven. And many times didst thou deliver them according to thy mercies, and testifiedest against them, that thou mightest bring them again under thy law. Yet they dealt proudly, and hearkened not unto the commandments, but sinned against thy judgments, which if a man do, he shall live in them. And withdrew his shoulder, and hardened their neck, and would not hear. Yet many years didst thou forbear them, and testified against them by the Spirit of thy prophets. Yet would they not give ear. Therefore gavest thou them into the hand of the people of the lands. Nevertheless, for thy great mercy's sake, thou didst not utterly consume them, nor forsake them, for thou art a gracious and merciful God.
Okay, there are a couple reasons why I wanted all these verses read, and you did a great job. Thank you. Number one, you have here a general picture of God. I mean, a lot of Hebrew history is kind of summed up in about 12 verses. But you have information here. God was gracious. He was kind to his people. He had the ability to help his people, and that's exactly what he did. And then you have some other information as well, and that is, as God helped his people, how did they sometimes respond? All right, they didn't always respond with the right attitude. Sometimes they were rebellious. Sometimes they just turned away from him and went over to other gods. And yet, even when those rebellious times came, what did God do? Did he just cut them off and say, well, okay, you guys turn from me, you're done. He was always there with plenty of power, a lot of mercy, great grace, willing to help bail them out. And he did that time and time again. The judges are a good example of that, as are the prophets. They encourage repentance. They said, look, you can turn. You can avoid some of the consequences. And God, you know, sent them prophets, which, as Nehemiah noted, they slew. So just many bad things as far as Hebrew history, but God was kind and kind and kind. So here's a question. Nehemiah says God is a God that's ready to pardon. He is gracious. He's merciful. He's slow to anger. He's of great kindness and someone who's not going to forsake his people. So that's well illustrated back here in the Old Testament, Nehemiah chapter 9. One other verse, and then we'll stop again for some comments. Psalm 89, verse 7.
God is greater than you fear in the assembly of the saints, and to be held in reverence by all those around.
Okay, our blanks. God is greatly to be feared, not in a bad sense, but again, you do need to respect him because of who he is, what he's capable of, and the fact that he is a righteous being. In the assembly of the saints, and to be had in reverence of all that are about him. If you were to take that passage and apply it to our assemblies today, how would you make it relevant? The assemblies of the saints, God is to be feared. Congregation. How can we make that relevant? Well, let's put it into a different format. Would you say that there are some assemblies today, Christians coming together, and why would they come together on Sunday? All right, coming together to worship, honor God. Where they don't demonstrate that reverence. They fail to give that respect. Yes or no? Could that happen?
Yes.
Yes. Do you think that does happen?
Yes.
Yes. What would be some illustrations of that happening?
Well,
you see people, okay, I'm going to start with my left since...
Not showing up would be the
biggest. All right, I think that's going to be one. People... if you have, for example, a birthday party, you could go for someone that you, are supposed to be a friend of, and you don't show up, you just, I'm going to sleep in, I'm going to watch TV or, whatever. It's just not a good demonstration of respect and friendship. Same thing applies to worship. So there is that. I don't want to cut you off, but did you have another part? Okay. All right, so we've got that. What else?
Well, you say, the people that want to visit back and forth during worship, I mean, we're here to worship, not to talk
okay.
to each other.
All right. People can be focused on other activities. Person-to-person visitation would be one. What else? Right?
I've seen, I think I've even experienced worship services where it seems like it's centered around the preacher or some worship coordinator or psalm leader even.
Okay. So, in addition to the visitation, you've also got sometimes an improper amount of attention focused on a person or a group. For example, you've got a singing group, choral group. Some congregations have tried to incorporate that into service, Come listen to the people sing and so forth. Well, that's not what we're here for. What else? What about a lack of attention? When you have somebody watching a football game, let's just say the game goes for 2 hours. If you had somebody, you've got some people that are really concentrating on the game. They're interested, they're focused on the game, and some other people come in and start doing some disruptive things. Do you think the TV watchers are going to be upset? The game's on. We want to watch the game. Don't disturb us. We'll talk about that, we'll do that, we'll deal with that after the game. Isn't that how it works? Well, when it comes to worship, shouldn't it be the same thing? We're here to worship. We're not here to play on the iPhone. We're not here to play on the tablet. We're not here to play cards or Scrabble or anything else. We're here to worship God. So it's a valuable lesson for us. And when we think about who God is, it's something that we want to make sure that we apply. Additional thoughts before we go on to our next reference?
Part of it is that how involved are you in that worship? Mm-hmm. Because there's even to the point where you don't think they know you're singing. They do. Mm-hmm. And then you hear people talk about why does so-and-so not sing?
That's true.
I knew preachers that way. They'd sit to the side and they wouldn't sing. I'm like, why?
Yeah. Well, unless you're sick and preserving your throat for the sermon, you've got to have a really good reason. But that's not really what you're describing here. But, and that is a problem. And you've had some guys, they're trying to write out the sermon, 10 minutes before they preach it. Well, that's also a problem. I mean, that's not the right time for that. So.
And people even are either, there's a list of things.
Yeah, there is. And again, there are people that, they've got an appointment or they've made a commitment, something like that, but you do have some people that, it's just, I want to get a head start and lunch or something else. Wait a minute. What you come for? Worship God. Related, at least somewhat to that, is the idea that people will go away from worship and say, I didn't get anything out of it. Now, wait a minute. Ideally, worship is going to be an uplifting experience. Ideally, we're going to come and enjoy the fellowship with brethren and some other things. But hold the horses on the idea that I didn't get anything out of worship. what should be one of the primary things that occurs when we come to worship? We've come to, I mean, worship means what? God, I'm offering this to you. You know, I'm coming as a giver, not so much a taker. And ideally, if we are involved with the giving, we're going to take some things away from it as well. But if our attitude is we're going to come and try to be the one who's the primary receiver, something's not quite right. But if we can get our mind into the fact that we are to be a giver, then we're going to probably profit a little bit more on the receiving end. But if we come focused on receiving, nobody talked to me, nobody did this, that, or the other thing, we're headed in the wrong direction, and it's not going to work out like God wants it to. Anybody else before we go on? Okay. Next passage is coming from 2 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 3. And then after that, we'll look at Romans chapter 15, verse 5. Who wants to take care of 2 Corinthians 1, 3? All right, Margaret, and then Josh, we'll ask you to get top of the next page from Romans 15, the 5th verse. Margaret, if you're ready, 2 Corinthians 1, verse 3. Okay, Paul says that God is the God of, or the Father, of mercies. He's the God of all comfort. What are some of the times where we want comfort in life? All right, I think that's one of the things. And during those times, I mean, we might not be thinking as well as we do on other occasions, but even during those times, isn't that a good reminder that we have a time that comes in our life when we can lay down the cares, the sicknesses, the illnesses, the diseases of this life, and we've got something to look forward to? Never again another sick day. That's a good thing. When else do we want to be comforted? All right, death. You know, I've never had to deal with somebody, at least not to my knowledge or not really close to me, that was an atheist, and you've got family members around. You know, he didn't believe in God. People want comfort when it comes to death. But if you're from a family of atheists, there is no comfort there, because in your mind, your life is over, the life of the loved one is gone, and there's just nothing that lies beyond this life. So we've got something. The God of all comfort can comfort during those times. Anything else? Disease? Death? All right, I'm going to use for another D, disaster. Times of trouble could include that, but it could also go well beyond that. So that's a good, broad, general answer. But times of disaster. Your house has been wiped out by an earthquake. Hurricane has swept in and destroyed everything, and you're sitting there with maybe just a little bit of the foundation left, and everything is gone. You know, you're 65 years old, and you're thinking, I'm just not going to live long enough to rebuild everything. If you have that secular mindset, that's going to be distressing. But if you're a Christian, you're thinking, where's my hope founded? It's not on the house. It's not on those possessions. It's heaven and the life eternal. So, again, the God of all comfort, that is literally true. Romans 15, verse 5, we've got that next.
May the God of endurance and encouragement grant you to live in such harmony with one another in accord with Christ Jesus.
Romans 15, 5?
Yep.
Okay. Okay, read that once again, Josh, if you would.
May God of endurance and encouragement grant you to live in such harmony with one another in accord with Christ Jesus.
Okay. Patience, endurance, depending on what you have there as far as the translation, you can see the connection between both. And then, okay, and then for the second blank, if you had the King James or something similar, you're going to have the word consolation. So in addition to being the God of all comfort, 2 Corinthians 1, 3, you've got the God of endurance, the God of consolation, and we saw a good illustration of that, in fact, several illustrations of that in Nehemiah chapter 9. Okay, before we move on to Revelation 21 and Galatians 6, anything that you want to interject? Revelation 21, verse 4, who wants to take care of that for us? Revelation 21, verse 4, Betty, and then from Galatians 6, verses 7 and 8. Galatians 6, 7 and 8, Lois. Revelation 21, 4. Betty? All right. I think I probably caused a few eyebrows to arch a little bit when we were going through Revelation 21. But my view of what he describes here is not heaven. I suggested in the class that when he talks about looking at the blanks that we want to fill in, God shall wipe away the tears and death and sorrow, crying and pain. Those things refer to the Christian era. They are figurative statements for the blessings that we have, For example, think about Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. You know, we're raised up to live with Christ. We have that spiritual life. The sorrow, the crying, the mourning that comes from sin, the pain that comes from that, we've got release. So I have no doubt that those things will also be removed in eternity. But I think that there is a great sense in which we also begin to experience them in this life. Galatians 6, 7 and 8. Okay, thinking about God and His power, Paul comes along and says, do not be deceived, don't be misled. God is not going to be mocked. Whatever a man sows, he's going to reap a crop from that. He that sows to the flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. He that sows to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. When you look at our country right now, we've got a lot of things that are being done which are not consistent with God's will. It's like in many respects, God is just being jabbed in the eye time after time after time. Now we know from Nehemiah 9, the passage that Jeff read, that extended section, plus a lot of other verses, old and new, that God is very patient, He's very kind, very tolerant in many ways. But we also find, Nehemiah 9 and some other texts, that a time comes where God says, you've jabbed me in the eye enough, and you're going to start paying some consequences for all the bad things that you've done. One wonders, at least I do, if America isn't beginning to reap some of the consequences from some of the seeds that it's sown. There just seems to be a lot of interesting things happening in the U.S. Not that California is worse than any other state, but I do think it's kind of interesting. Anybody see the piece that came out yesterday? They've got big water shortage out there, creating problems for a lot of people, including the marijuana growers. They've got illegal marijuana growers, and they really need water for the weed. I guess marijuana requires a lot of water. Well, you know, when people start doing things that are inconsistent with God's will, you know, God may not completely shut off the spigot, no pun intended, but, you know, He can start applying some pressure and doing some things. He's worked through the weather in the past. He's worked through disease in the past. He's worked through, you know, food and famine, various things. So I don't know that we want to be completely dismissive of the things that take place in our world as simply being, well, it's just a bad period of time. It's all coincidental. God can't do anything. He can. And He's not acting in the supernatural, the miraculous way that He did in the past, but He is no less powerful. Thoughts that you have before we move on with the next few verses. Doug?
Every time I read this verse, this is a memory verse from way back when. It reminds me of those that says, well, what about the person that repents on their deathbed? I've shown this verse. God said He's not going to be mocked. I'm not saying it can't happen. It's up to God. But don't look your whole life thinking that you're going to be forgiven at your deathbed, because God says He's not going to be mocked by that.
Yeah. And two, I think you can add to that thought, when a person has lived in sin for, let's say, 50, 60, 70 years, you're going to reap a mindset that is very anti-God. And you might be able, as you said, to turn from that at the very last minute. But the chance of that, also as you indicated, is going to be very, very slight, because you have just continually infused in your mind that life of sin. And the chance of extracting yourself from that before you head out is very, very slim.
I think that's why he says, be not deceived.
Yeah, right. And if you're thinking that you're just going to be able to wrap everything up at the end, don't count on it. I mean, it's almost a fool's hope. Not that, as you said, it's impossible. But again, you are playing with fire to the nth degree if you do that. Anybody else? All right. Ephesians 2, verse 4, and then Acts 17, 24 and 25. Who wants to take our Ephesians 2 verse 4 reference? Brian? After that, we'll go to the book of Acts and look at Acts 17 verses 24 and 25. Lisa? Brian, you ready? Ephesians 2 verse 4.
But God, who is rich in mercy because of His great love wherewith He loved us.
Okay. God is what in what? He's rich in mercy. Well, that's good news. There are things sometimes that we want in abundance, and this is one of the things that we want from God. We're interested in mercy, and it's great news that He's rich in mercy. He's willing to give it. He's ready to give it. He's anxious to give it if people will respond to Him in the way that He's described. Acts 17, verses 24 and 25. Paul and the Athenians.
God that made the world and all the things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and the earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things.
Okay. If God was able to make the world, made it from nothing, called it into existence when there was no matter to work with, if you will, is he able to help us with our problems? Absolutely. Going to help us in a different way than what we find with some of the miraculous activity in the past, but he is certainly very capable, very able when it comes to helping us. And then, this is almost comical to me. It's still not uncommon for people today to kind of, if you will, put God in a box. You know, God, his presence is over there in the church building, or, you know, here's where we find God. If you think about that mentality, and you compare it with what's said in Acts 17, what did God create? The world! Well, if he created the world, how can you contain him in a box or a building? That just doesn't make any sense at all, does it? The box or the building wouldn't be here had it not been for God and his creation. So it really is kind of an ironic view and almost twisted thinking when people look at God and they say, well, he lives in the church sanctuary, quote-unquote, or something like that. So he's not going to dwell in some kind of temple, and you know, that's going to be his primary presence. He's above the world, outside the world, always has been, and always will be. So that's what we mean when we say he's omnipresent. There's not a place where he fails to be. The other part of the verse that we want to pick up, God does not dwell in temples made with hands. Well, if he's making the world, then of course that's not going to be the way that things work with him. He's not worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything. When it comes to life and breath and all things, where do they come from? God. He was the maker of the world. He's also the one responsible for humanity. Anything that you want to add or ask before we look at Exodus 19 and Philippians 4? Exodus 19:16, Betty, and then after that we'll take a look at Philippians 4, verse 19. Who wants to be responsible for that? Lois, thank you. Philippians 4, verse 19. Okay, next is Exodus 19, verse 16.
And it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain, and the voice of the trumpet exceeding loud, so that all the people that were in the camp trembled.
Okay, our blanks. His presence, God's presence, was made known by what things? There was thundering. We have lightning, plural. We have a thick cloud and also the trumpet. You can pick just really any one of those, but they all kind of stand out, and God's used some of these things. These items are sometimes used to picture God's presence. Anybody see the BNP from a couple of days ago? It was that special cloud formation in Australia. Okay, at least if you did. Had you seen that before anywhere in the world? I mean, I'm sure it has. They claim that that can be created by jets and some other things. It really is amazing. People, where they called it the rapture cloud and some other things, and it really is a very, very unique formation. Connecting that to what we have here in Exodus chapter 19, if people saw this cloud, and it was kind of like a rainbow doorway, that's the best way I can describe it, kind of looked like a doorway with, you know, various colors in it. If people were impressed by that, thinking, oh, this might signify the end of the world or the rapture that some people believe in, but that's not mentioned in the Bible. If people thought that was impressive, then what about being in the presence of God? The thunder, the thick cloud, the lightning, and so forth. It's going to be something that is really amazing, just completely unlike anything that we see on the earth. Philippians 4, verse 19. Okay, God's going to supply how many of their needs? All their needs, according to his riches in the glory of Christ Jesus. You see this kind of thing in bulletin articles every once in a while, and he didn't go all the way through it, but people have noted that to an artist, Christ or God is the one who's altogether. To the architect, he's the chief cornerstone. To the astronomer, he's the son of righteousness. To the baker, he's the living bread. To the banker, he's the hidden treasure. To the biologist, he's life. To the carpenter, he's the sure foundation. And it just goes on and on and on about various occupations, how God kind of relates himself in some way to those kinds of things. And that is right. He's able to supply all our needs. He is all that we need. He covers everything fully. There's nothing that is lacking. or insufficient about Him. Proverbs 3 verse 5 says, trust in the Lord with how much? All thine heart. Don't lean on your own understanding. And then you have this challenge: in all thy ways acknowledge Him, and He's going to direct your paths. Well, that's right. When we think about who He is, the power He has, the Scriptures that describe Him, He's able to see us through whatever we go through in life, as we'll see in the lessons that follow. He's the God who parted the waters there at the Red Sea. Israel was able to pass over on dry land. God provided the manna, the quail. Those provisions were made for the nation as they were in the wilderness. Then we come to the Queen of Sheba, 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 19. She said to Solomon, what's that first word that we want? What be? The Lord thy God? Blessed. She was impressed. She knew that God had delighted in this man. And then you have some other people, the heathen at Mount Carmel. They saw the fire come down, consume the water-soaked sacrifice. Their God had failed to respond to the cries. The heathen powers that they served had not been successful. And then they said, the Lord, He is God. 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 39. They were not the only ones. You think about Pharaoh, and in Moses' time, his response as well. You have the plagues. And then finally, you get down to Exodus 9, verse 27. The Lord is righteous. I and my people are wicked. So they were faced with God's righteousness. They were faced with His power. And they concluded that they were not on the right side of things. If Pharaoh and his group, his helpers, made this admission when they were not in God's presence, in the sense that people will be on the day of judgment, can you imagine what it's going to be like for the wicked when they're actually exposed to God's presence? I mean, Pharaoh comes right out and says, okay, look, he really wasn't convicted, but when it's time for people to appear before the Lord, it's going to be a much, much different situation. Nebuchadnezzar also had a chance to have some interaction with God, and he learned some lessons. He says, after the census came back to him, I bless the Most High, and I praised and honored Him that lives forever, whose dominion or power is an everlasting dominion, and His kingdom is from generation to generation. So this great God that we read about throughout the Old Testament, that we read about throughout the New Testament, He says to us throughout the Christian era, I want to be with you, I want to help you, I want you to be my people, I want to be your God, and I will see you safely through this life. I'll also help you have a great eternity if you're willing to follow me. Additional thoughts that you want to